Good afternoon. Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely, Santina Chakotay on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Rashawn Miller. The core issue in this case is to what degree a police officer may rely upon an anonymous tip necessary to justify a seizure. We respectfully suggest that the facts on this record before this court did not rise to the level of either probable cause or reasonable suspicion, since both standards require minimal corroboration of details in order to establish the requisite probable cause or reasonable suspicion for the seizure.
Well, let me interrupt you there, because as I understand the facts, although the informant was not a past proven reliable one, the informant did provide certain information as to what parking spots would be used and what time of day this would go down, and then actually even contacted the police officers and said, he's here. Aren't those three things corroboration of what started out just being a tip and therefore sufficient?
They are the most minimal of corroborated facts, Your Honor, and respectfully, based on the decisions of this court, and more importantly, the United States Supreme Court, with the holdings of Alabama versus White and JL versus Florida, two cases that this court has stood by in many decisions, what Your Honor just described is insufficient for reasonable suspicion or probable cause for the seizure in this case. And there are really two deficiencies with the lower court's decision, which the record points to. And the first one deals with the assumption that the characterization that the seizure was supported by reasonable articulable suspicion. That finding implies that there was an attempt to effect a Terry-type stop, which is, as this court has recently held, a temporary limited detention and question of an individual to ascertain more information to determine whether there's enough to extend that seizure. What essentially happened under these facts is there was what would be characterized as a custodial seizure, more akin to an arrest.
When is knowledge of an itinerary sufficient to allow an inference that the CI has inside information, including information regarding illegal conduct? How much has to be known?
Well, Your Honor, the benchmark seems to be Alabama versus White. And in Alabama versus White, which I think is significant to this case, which actually the state relies on primarily as for the Lynch Penalty case, we had a confidential informant indicate that Vanessa White, the target of the investigation, would come out of apartment 235C. She would get into a brown Plymouth station wagon with a cracked taillight, and she would be in possession of narcotics, and she would then proceed to drive to a particular motel. In that case, the U.S. Supreme Court found that that was sufficient, and the reason is because they had the police corroborated the make of the car, they had the defendant's name and information, they knew the destination, but the most critical factor of that case is that the court described it as borderline. And so what we have is a benchmark. What the U.S. Supreme Court has given us a benchmark to evaluate other cases. Like when this court handled Flannery, Jones, LeGrand, and Sierra, those cases did not meet that benchmark that Alabama versus White provides. And that's the fatal flaw in the state's case.
So what was missing here?
Everything, Your Honor, respectfully. There was no names of the target of the investigation, no model of the vehicle, there was no there was no age. There was literally, when you boil down the tip to its simplest form, it's two African-American males, one lighter complexion than the other, arriving at an apartment complex, and they may occupy one of four possible parking spaces. That's what they had.
At a particular time?
In a particular window of time.
Right.
Between 11 and 1 o'clock. So, under those facts, based on the holdings of the United States Supreme Court, that would fall on the side of insufficient corroboration. That's what this case hinges on. And the other significant deficiency in the lower court's reasoning, and it's unclear how the court came to the finding, considering the testimony of Detective Popp, but the court found that this particular confidential informant, now Detective Popp calls him a cooperating individual. It's important to note that that has no legal significance. That term is essentially an anonymous tipster, is what's going on here.
Well, does the record reflect whether the person really was anonymous? He may not have been past proven reliable, but he did interact with the police on several occasions during the course of the day. Are you saying they did not know who they were talking to?
That's what the record would suggest, Your Honor. There's no testimony from Detective Popp as to the credibility, believability, or veracity of who this individual was. And that's actually one of the errors.
Well, that's a separate point. And my question is, did they know the person's name?
The record would suggest that they did not. No. No. There's no testimony regarding who this confidential informant was.
How about a phone number or anything identifying who the caller was on the by cell phone?
There's nothing on the record, Your Honor, as to that as well. And again, one of the major deficiencies in the lower court's reasoning is a finding that this cooperating individual, this anonymous tipster, gave specific information regarding his past dealings with the defendant. That's not supported in the record at all. There's nothing to that effect in the record.
Is there anything describing the area where they were seen as a high crime area or anything like that in the record?
No, Your Honor. There's an address of a apartment complex and one of four possible parking spaces that the individuals would park in. And I would note of significant relevance is that if we look at the guidance of the U.S. Supreme Court, Alabama versus White, and in JL versus Florida, one of the significant factors is this predictive behavior. What happens in this case is it's almost a live play-by-play. When the call comes in that the car is here, what's happening is not the car is going to arrive. The communication is, that's the car, it's going to park. That's happening live. That's a live play-by-play. That isn't predictive in nature. That isn't JL versus Florida where, you know, somebody mentioned there's going to be someone at a bus stop wearing a plaid shirt, or an Alabama versus White. Vanessa White is going to come out of that apartment at 4 o'clock or whenever in that time zone. She's going to get in a brown Plymouth station wagon, and she's going to drive to a particular location.
Well, let's go back to what we're looking for, no matter what the facts are. Are we looking for a reasonable, articulable suspicion or probable cause? Let's assume that it's a reasonable, articulable suspicion. And based on whatever the police had, they blocked in the car of the defendants.
That's correct.
And the defendants fled almost immediately.
Yes.
And to the extent contraband was recovered, most of it started with plain view, because when they abandoned the vehicle, they left the doors open. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So are we correct in saying the real question is, was there a reasonable, articulable suspicion of criminal activity based on this information the police had to block in the car and question these people?
If I could answer your question in two parts, Your Honor. We suggest that there was not even reasonable, articulable suspicion for the stop because it wasn't what a Terry stop would amount to, which is a limited scope in nature. For example, if we look at Flannery, there's some guidance there where the officers approach the passenger and the driver's side window, knock on the window, "Hi, can we please speak with so-and-so?" In this case, they had a nickname. As opposed to taking a less aggressive approach, if I may, to parking, as the record indicates, nose to nose to the car, that's more of the probable cause analysis of a custodial seizure akin to an arrest. However, respectfully,
why do you say that? I mean, there are all sorts of degrees of stops.
Correct.
But once you're stopped, you're stopped.
That's correct.
So this was a fairly enthusiastic stop.
Yes.
But why do we want to characterize it as an arrest?
Because the alternative, because if it were a 1902 type stop or a Terry type stop, you have more of an investigative approach to the contact. The interaction is less aggressive, as happened here. But respectfully, Your Honor, the difference is immaterial in this case. Whether the court's looking for reasonable suspicion or probable cause, the Fourth Amendment violation and the violation under the Delaware Constitution happened as soon as the seizure occurred. When the car went nose to nose with the defendant's vehicle, that's when the violation occurred. Anything after that, we respectfully submit as immaterial to the purposes of this case.
Now, you cited the Delaware Constitution. Was that fairly presented below, consistent with Ortiz?
We believe so, Your Honor. Yes, we would submit that argument was made. Again, in the alternative, the violation is under the Fourth Amendment as well. If the court should not find that the Delaware argument was not presented, the Fourth Amendment was presented throughout.
So if we're talking about probable cause, once the United States Supreme Court moved away from the two-part test in Aguilar and Spinelli, it goes to the totality of the circumstances under Illinois v. Gates.
That's correct.
And the question for us is, even if this person was not a past proven reliable informant, did he provide enough specific information that was independently corroborated to reach whatever threshold we're looking for?
That's correct. And that's what's missing here. And the state points to Alabama versus White. That's precisely the reason why this case fails, because what we have in JL versus Florida is a reiteration from the United States Supreme Court that the facts under Alabama versus White was a borderline case. That's the term coined by the U.S. Supreme Court. It's borderline. It was close. There's our benchmark. When we have anything below that, it's insufficient. That's precisely what this court has held time and time again in LeGrand, Flannery, Sierra. When you have less than what is needed of corroborative information or from a proven reliable informant, it isn't enough.
Can I ask you, is part of your argument that when the confidential informant telephoned the police and said, "He's here," or "They're here," was that corroboration or not?
We would suggest that it's not. Again, that's precisely the live play-by-play, the non-predictive behavior that is so critical in these types of analysis.
Well, if a confidential informant says these two guys are going to show up between 11 and 1 and they're going to park in one of these parking spaces because they're going to be doing a drug deal with me, and then sometime between 11 and 1 he calls the police and says they're here, hasn't he made a prediction and now corroborated it?
It's minimal corroboration and minimal predictive behavior. It's, again, the record that we have here before the court is two African-American males, one lighter complexion than the other. I would argue any two people side by side, one's going to be a little darker than the other, no matter what race or nationality they may be. That is the most minimal information they have. They have no names. They have no height, no weight. They have no description of the vehicle.
But even without that, they've got a confidential informant who recognizes them and says, those are the two.
A confidential informant, Your Honor, that was not proven and reliable. And that's the fatal flaw in this case, is that under Delaware law, if your confidential informant or your anonymous tipster is not past proven and reliable, you have to go to the Gates analysis, as Justice Holland pointed out, and under the totality of the circumstances, under Alabama versus White and JL versus Florida, there had better be some predictive behavior or specific information.
Or is there anything in the record regarding how the other cars were parked, for instance, pulling into a parking lot and backing into the space? Is there that an unusual way of parking in this area that sort of showed a particular unusual activity, perhaps designed for a fast getaway?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. That issue wasn't touched upon either on direct or cross-examination of the detective. From personal experience, I don't drive a vehicle, but I see people park cars in the most oddest of forms, depending on what kind of skills they might have to park a vehicle.
Well, so the record's silent as to this particular lot and whether other cars were parked that way.
That's correct. And I think what's also significant is you don't have a particular parking space that's being predicted. It's, well, one of four parking spaces. We don't know if this complex had 10 parking spaces, 20 parking spaces, 5 parking spaces, but they had a range. I see I'm approaching my time, if I may preserve it for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely, Maria Knoll representing the state of Delaware. In this particular case, Your Honors, the police officers had a reasonable articulable suspicion to stop Mr. Miller's vehicle based upon the specific and largely predictive information they received from the informant in this case. In addition, there was independent police corroboration of some of the information prior to the stop, which provided a sufficient indicia of reliability of the informant's tip. An informant's tip may provide reasonable suspicion where the totality of the circumstances, if corroborated, indicates that the information is reliable. And in making that determination, a court must consider the reliability of the informant, the details contained in that informant's tip, and the degree to which the informant's tip is corroborated by independent police surveillance and information. In this particular case, Your Honors, the police had been in contact with this informant and had had discussions, according to Officer Pop, with this informant. This informant provided information that on January 14, 2010, between the hours of 11 and 1, two young black males, one darker than the other, would be driving a vehicle to the Town Court's apartments located off of 8th and Walnut Street and be parking backwards in 3 to 4 in a range of 3 to 4 parking spots in that location. The informant did indicate to the police that they would be meeting him. The informant also indicated and was available by phone during the entire time of the surveillance, which was that 2-hour window, and at 11:38, which is between 11 and 1, a car matching the description
pulls in. Available by phone, does that mean the police had his phone number?
Your Honor, from the record and from what Officer Pop testified to, the state would submit that it's readily inferable that the officer had direct communication by phone with the informant. He did not say, "I have his phone number," but he indicated that he was available by phone and that they were conversing back and forth during the time.
Did he say who was calling whom?
He did not give a name, Your Honor.
No, I mean, was the call placed by the CI or call placed by the police officer?
I believe at the time that the car came in, it was the CI that contacted the officer, Your Honor.
Right. Does the record indicate what motivated the CI to do this?
The record does not indicate that, Your Honor. The record does indicate that the informant indicated he had prior dealings with these defendants and that they were coming in to meet him. That is what it indicates.
Right. Well, my question is, why does someone who has agreed to buy drugs and would otherwise appear to be engaged in criminal activity have an epiphany and decide, "I'm going to throw aside my prior past and I'm going to call the police and turn in my colleagues, and I'm just going to do that with no expectation of anything in return"?
Your Honor, I believe generally it's done to work off charges. However, the question was that indicated on the record, and it was not on the record below, the motivation.
And that is a reasonable inference, isn't it?
I believe it's a reasonable inference, yes, Your Honor.
So somewhere along the line, this confidential informant would have said to the police, "Hey, I've got information that could be helpful to you. Here it is." And in return, he was expecting something in return. But if he was working off the charges, and then what we really have is a situation where this person was in the system, so to speak, and part of his deal once he was in the system was, "I'll help you arrest other people, and in consideration for my help, I'll get favorable treatment with regard to my pending charges."
Correct, Your Honor. And in other words, that would mean he would have a personal interest in this actually being a correct tip.
Right. It would also mean he's not anonymous.
Not to the police, no, Your Honor.
Because he's expecting something in return.
I believe that's inferable from the record, yes, Your Honor. It was made quite clear by the informant that they were meeting him with the quantity of drugs in their car.
So what we see is not unusual in drug cases where this person's working off the charges, in quotes, and the police would like that person to continue working. To that extent, and they're not revealing his identity unless it's absolutely necessary or perhaps after a Flowers hearing.
That is correct, Your Honor. For safety concerns, they would not want to release his name.
So if we come full circle, all of this depends on how specific was the information and whether it could be corroborated independently.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the state would submit that based upon the facts of this case and the amount of information given by this informant, that there was clearly reasonable suspicion justifying the stop of these individuals, which happened at the time that the police blocked in the vehicle.
Well, wasn't it sufficient merely in tending to identify who these individuals would be as opposed to the illegality of their conduct? Was there anything to, by investigation or other corroboration, that supported an inference that there was illegal conduct?
The police themselves did not see any illegal conduct at that time, Your Honor. The informant had indicated that he had dealt with these individuals with drugs in the past, and basic predictive behavior given by the informant was of the events leading up to the actual seizure by the officers. Had the police seen the drugs on their own, I suppose we wouldn't even be here right now. It would have been an issue of they would have had the reasonable suspicion and probable cause on their own if they had seen it without the help of the CI. But under Illinois v. Gates, it's pretty clear that if an informant's tip is corroborated and even innocent activity is corroborated, it lends reliability to the illegal activity as well, to his to the information he gives with regard to the illegal activity.
And there's no question on this record but that the informant was planning to buy drugs from the people who were going to arrive.
I believe either planning to buy drugs or assist them with the drugs, yes, Your Honor.
So there's a admission against penal interest that was in play here as well?
There was an admission by the informant that they were there to meet him.
Suggesting what? What's the inference?
The inference is that he was aware that the drugs were coming and he was part of it, I would suggest, Your Honor.
Well, that's why I asked my earlier question. If he was working off the charges...
Yes, Your Honor.
And I assume he has to start somewhere.
That's
so
correct.
If this was his first cooperation, and I guess the police really couldn't say he was past proven reliable, but... And the state seems to be playing this extremely close to the vest with regard to protecting the identity of the confidential informant. And whether he was past proven reliable or not, the state's not taking that position. And they're having their entire case rest on the specificity of his information and whether it could be corroborated independently. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, and also the fact that he was not anonymous to the police officers.
Well... How do we know that?
The police officer had indicated that he had had more than one discussion with the informant and that the informant and he were in contact over the phone at the time of the two-hour surveillance.
Why isn't that just an anonymous tip over the phone?
To have the police officer's phone number as opposed to a 911 call, Your Honor, it would be readily inferable that they've had some contact. He has the officer's direct cell phone line as opposed to just calling the 911 operator and saying, can you please put me in contact with this officer?
Okay. So let me see if what we've left out. And we have a description of the individuals.
Correct.
And we have the time and place with a window of where they're going to be. And we have the indication that when they arrive, they will back into the parking space.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Anything else? Well, and then we have his call to the police saying that's them.
That's confirming behavior. The other part is predicted behavior. Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. And on the particular date that it was going to happen, yes.
If we affirm, would this allow, for instance, this scenario, a disgruntled neighbor knows that another neighbor regularly drives someone home from work and parks at a certain area in the apartment complex and calls the police and says there's going to be, and describes the car, and they've got to have drugs in the car, and the police, based on that tip, sees them, ultimately find nothing, but it would authorize that type of conduct?
Your Honor, would that be an anonymous call-in by someone?
Yes, assume it's anonymous.
In the case of an anonymous call-in of someone just saying, you're going to see this person, they park here every day, scenario, that person does not put themselves liable to anything because it's an anonymous call-in. In this particular case, it's different. This person, this informant, the police have him in the area. They are able to get in touch with him. There is reason to believe that he would want to be truthful with respect to the information he gave, and he would have to answer to it if it was false as well. Also, with respect to saying someone parks here every day, that is one thing. To say that on this particular day, in the next 2 hours or so, someone will be parking here, that is specific knowledge of what someone is going to do that day. Although somebody generally does something every day, it's not a guarantee. And in this particular case, they said this is going to happen today between the hours of 11 and 2 because he is meeting 11 and 1 because they are meeting me. So the specificity is more than that, and it is not an anonymous tip of just a disgruntled neighbor calling in.
So this case then turns on whether or not there was anonymity by the CI?
I believe it is helpful under the totality of the circumstances that this wasn't anonymous. I believe in certain circumstances, anonymous with sufficient corroboration could be enough for reasonable suspicion. And given the facts in this case, they're sort of intertwined. It would be difficult to say that a completely anonymous tip could have arranged this sort of surveillance by the police.
Well, you've used two legal standards in one sentence.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Which is fine. If you're talking about totality of the circumstances in the layman's sense, mm-hmm. and saying under the totality of the circumstances there was a reasonable, articulable suspicion, that's fine. Or are you trying to contend that there were, under the totality of the circumstances, there was probable cause under Gates?
No, Your Honor, in this case, I believe there was the reasonable suspicion for the stop. I believe that in this particular case it would amount to probable cause, but the standard in this case when the detention happened was reasonable suspicion.
Okay.
The court has nothing further.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think one of the apparent, readily apparent issues in this case is how slim the record is. The record is silent on so many of the issues that are paramount in this type of analysis. The reason why the officers could not corroborate sufficient information is because there wasn't enough information to corroborate. And I'd like to also point out to the court there's a distinction between corroborating to the extent that they have the person, the target of the investigation at issue, and then there's corroboration of illegal activity. That's absent in this case.
Is there sufficient evidence to allow an inference of, A, that the informant was not anonymous but was known to the police, and B, that the informant was basically making a declaration against his penal interest in that he was going to be involved in the transaction?
The record would suggest that there isn't enough to make those inferences. I would argue that's speculation, Your Honor. Respectfully, that would be speculation. The state concedes that this informant is not proven past reliable informant. And when that's the situation, you're essentially left with a tip that's, you can't verify its veracity. That's the problem.
Well, isn't that always going to be the situation in the hypothetical scenario that someone's working off their existing charges, and this is your first attempt to provide some positive evidence for the police?
That may be the case, but it doesn't take away from the standard in these type of situations that the U.S. Supreme Court has spelled out, where these are essentially anonymous tips. There still has to be the test still has to be met. You still have to, if the reliable informant, for example, this court handled the Tatum case, a case that's in our papers to this court. In that case, you had multiple fact-checking. If an informant mentions that 1 + 1 = 2, we might assume it must be correct, but unless you know that the informant is good at math, it's not going to amount to enough on the record to make him a past-proven, reliable informant. And that's really the problem in this case, is that the record is so slim. There's no description of a vehicle. There's no description of clothes. There's no description of age. There's no description of height. It's as generic of a description that you can get. And the hypothetical suggested by Justice Ridgely is precisely the reason why a case like this could have negative consequences should it be permitted.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court appreciates your arguments in this case, and we will adjourn.